From the Danker's studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're taking a close look at organic labeling in the United States. How does a product end up as being certified organic? And what about the differences between 100% organic and made with organic ingredients? Also, just who is it who's actually deciding what constitutes organic? And how does the product you pick up in the grocery store actually end up with its label? We'll be speaking with former U.S. Department of Agriculture Deputy Secretary Kathleen Marigan, who runs the George Washington University's Sustainability Institute, to learn more. That conversation and your summary of the day's top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. Welcome back to The Rundown this afternoon. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, the first in a two-part conversation about what organic means in food in the United States. But first up, we have these headlines. Airport officials say a Southwest Airlines flight from Denver landed safely in Salt Lake City after a pilot reported the smell of smoke in the cockpit 20 minutes before landing. Salt Lake City International Airport spokeswoman Barbara Gann said that there were no indications of any fire on Southwest Flight 1291 on Tuesday morning, and that the smell of smoke had dissipated by the time the plane landed. Gann says the plane taxied to the gate and passengers disembarked as normal. She says that crews are checking the aircraft as a precaution. No delays have been reported at the airport. Flight records show the plane left from Kansas City, Missouri around 7 a.m. and made a stop in Denver an hour later before arriving in Salt Lake City around 10 a.m. on Tuesday morning. The Days of 47 parade, held in July on Pioneer Day, is the biggest parade in Utah. On Friday, a group promoting better relations between the LGBT community and Mormons announced that their application to enter the parade had been rejected by Days of 47 organizers. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has more.
For the first time, Mormons Building Bridges intended to participate in the Days of 47 parade this summer. According to the group, they applied to enter a single car with eight LGBT leaders from the community. The title of the entry was Mormons Building Bridges Celebrates Utah's LGBT Pioneers. That entry was rejected by parade organizers. Here's Mormons Building Bridges co-chair Erica Munson relaying what parade co-chair Jodine Smith told her about the rejection.
She said that due to the subject matter and under the parade's general standards, the parade's co-chairs will not be able to permit your application at this time.
KCPW reached Smith for comment on this story, but she declined to be interviewed. However, she did say that this was only the second LGBT-related application parade organizers had ever received, and that one was rejected for being past deadline. Munson says she and her group are very disappointed, calling the parade a, quote, beloved state tradition.
LGBT Mormons in particular actually look to the pioneers with great reverence and honor as a group that was cast out, that was marginalized, that was considered the other, but that eventually triumphed.
The general standards section of the Days of 47 parade entry form bans any entry that is, quote, political, controversial, unlawful, or otherwise inconsistent with the standards, theme, or purpose of the parade, unquote. The form cites examples such as, quote, subject matters relating to sexuality, including polygamy and abortion, controversial religious matters, and gun rights, unquote. Munson acknowledges that the private parade can allow whomever they want to participate. She also says her group has been told they are free to view the parade from the side, but she feels like that marginalizes them.
The message of the parade is pioneers pushing toward the future. And, hey, that's what the LGBT Utahns who have been brave to stand up for who they are and who have had great accomplishments in the various areas of their life. They're really pushing toward the future. So we don't see anything that's not in harmony with the parade. And we love the parade, and we just would love to be a part of it.
In its two-year history, Mormons Building Bridges may have made its biggest impact as a participant in a different parade, the Utah Pride Parade. They first marched in that parade in 2012. There's no official number of the group's size, but their Facebook group claims about 4,900 members. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
University of Utah President David Pershing says he agrees it's time to consider some changes to the school's fight song that some find sexist. Pershing announced Monday that he's asking the Office of Student Affairs to oversee a committee that will weigh a, quote, modest update to the song Utah Man. Student government leaders passed a resolution last month urging changes in the century-old song with lyrics that include "Our co-eds are the fairest." The Salt Lake Tribune reports the faculty's academic senate threw its support behind the effort on Monday. Pershing says he's committed to the importance of, quote, both tradition and inclusion, close quote. He's asking students, faculty, staff, alumni, and others to suggest new lyrics through May 31st. Finally today, a judge has agreed to allow lawyers for a group of Utah dairy farmers to investigate whether the power plant they sued tainted the jury pool in rural Juab County, resulting in a mistrial last fall. Attorneys for the farmers say power plant executives threatened that the Intermountain Power Plant near Delta could close and jobs would be lost if the farmers' suit was successful. Intermountain Power's attorney Francis Wilkstrom disputes that the jury pool was tainted. The Salt Lake Tribune reports Judge James Brady has given both sides until May 17th to propose how to investigate the matter. Millard County farmers claimed in their lawsuit that stray electricity from the Intermountain Power Plant near the town of Delta was making dairy cows sick. And that does it for a summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay tuned. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. When you're at the grocery store, what exactly does the label organic mean? As a consumer, you probably have certain expectations for the products that you buy with the organic label. How organic is defined varies widely from country to country, and in the U.S., what the word means varies too, depending on what the label says. To help us sort through the meaning of organic and more, joining us now by phone is Kathleen Merrigan, former Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Executive Director of the Sustainability Institute at the George Washington University. Ms. Merrigan, thank you very much for making the time today.
Glad to do so.
I thought that we could begin by defining what the organic label means. Maybe you could explain that for us. What is organic?
Bottom line, it's the strongest environmental label on food that anybody can purchase. Now, there's a lot of consumer confusion about what organic is, and the reason why, I believe, is it's a very complicated group of standards that go to water quality, air quality, wildlife habitat, biodiversity, a very prescriptive, extensive standard that farmers and processors have to follow. So you wanted the short definition, super environmental. Longer definition, you'd have to give me some more airtime.
You know, and I'm happy to give you a little bit more. And I think it's really interesting to hear how much of this is about the environmental considerations, because I think many consumers kind of assume that it has to do with their own well-being, their own health. And so that's interesting to hear. But to delve in deeper, I know that there are three tiers of organics. There's something like 100% organic, a label that is just organic, and then another one that is made with organic ingredients. Can we kind of parse those out?
Certainly. And this was all established by law in 1990 and by rulemaking that put the program fully in place in 2002. And those tiers have been around. The idea is, of course, if you have an organically produced apple, it is 100% organic, no question about it. Organic, if it just says organic on the primary display label, it means it's at least 95% organic content. There are some things in there that don't really fit organic, like baking soda, for example. So we consider it organic, but to be 100% honest with the consumer, we just say organic. And then made with organic ingredients. This is a lower content, and this is so that companies that are striving to put more and more organic in their processed food can have a label claim that consumers can recognize as they strive to get to that higher level, organic and 100% organic.
Can I ask, are there no antibiotics or hormones in foods labeled as organic?
There are no antibiotics or hormones in foods labeled as organic. True. Yes, and this was something that consumers spoke loudly to when the federal government asked them whether there should be antibiotics and hormones in organic food, and they said absolutely not. In fact, a lot of that's in statute. But there is one exception to this rule, and that is currently an antibiotic agent is allowed in apple production. It's a controversial issue. It's been debated by the National Organic Standards Board, which makes recommendations to the Secretary of Agriculture about what the exceptions to the no synthetic use in organic production can be. And that's the only place where you see any antibiotics. Most people, when you hear hormones, antibiotics, you're thinking livestock agriculture, you're thinking your meat and poultry. And for sure, there's no antibiotics or hormones there.
How about when it comes to living conditions of animals? That's what you were just describing. But when it comes to labels like cage-free or other considerations for animals, are those factors in gaining the organic label, for example?
Midway through the first term of the Obama administration, when I was in office, we had huge success because we finally got out what is known as the pasture rule, which is particular to ruminants, dairy cows, for example, how much time they have to be out on pasture, which is not only better for the animal in terms of health, it's also increasingly we're seeing that grass-fed dairy animals produce milk with higher omega-3s and that sort of thing. So there are places where organic standards really do embrace animal welfare components, but it's, again, a moving target. These standards just keep becoming stricter and stricter, and the NOSB is engaged in discussions about several aspects of animal welfare.
And that's the National Organic Standards Board, as you mentioned before. I did want to ask about is the use of pesticides on crops, is that a consideration in the organic label?
Absolutely. Organic farmers can use pesticides, but they have to be natural pesticides. And they can't be all natural. Some naturals are prohibited. For example, arsenic. Back in the olden days, farmers would use arsenic as a pesticide. Well, obviously, we know that's not a good thing, and that's prohibited. But there's a process that other naturals can be deemed inappropriate for organic production. The basic rule of organic is if it's natural, it's okay. And if it's synthetic, it's not. But there are exceptions on both sides. In terms of an allowable synthetic, oftentimes farmers use pheromones for mating disruption of insects. Hmm. Well, the truth of the matter is it'd be very hard to squeeze the little behinds of a lot of insects to get the right amount of insect pheromone that you need.
Right.
Like my very scientific language, right?
Right.
But, and so what we do is we create a synthetic version of that in the laboratory. So most consumers, when they hear that, they're absolutely fine with it, but truth be told, it's synthetic. So that's why we have this national list process that's overseen by the National Organic Standards Board to safeguard organic and to determine what naturals should be banned, that otherwise we think we're okay, and what synthetics we should say are okay, which would otherwise be banned.
Hmm. When we talk about the National Organic Standards Board, who makes it up and how do they actually operate? I mean, they're the ones who are deciding what organic means as that term evolves.
So I've given a lot of thought about this. I helped write the law that set up the board and its composition of 15 members, farmers, processors, environmentalists, scientists, retailers. I mean, there's a whole composition that's dictated by law. I served for 5 years as an environmental representative on that board, and I've also appointed members to that board when I was in an administrative role at USDA. So I've seen it from all sides, if you will. The board is supposed to be an advisory board to USDA and all things organic, except for their specific role in developing this national list, again, this list of exceptions. They have statutory authority to do that, and they recommend it to the secretary. If the board doesn't recommend a synthetic material to be on that national list, the Secretary of Agriculture can't unilaterally put it on the list. This goes back to an old history of organic. I mean, now we have a president and we have a secretary of agriculture who are very positive and promotional of organic, but there were the dark times, in my opinion, when that wasn't the case. And so when we were drafting the law back in the late 1980s, there was a lot of anxiety about handing over the reins of power to the U.S. Department of Agriculture that had not been friendly to organic. So we vested the citizen board with certain powers.
That's an interesting structure that you're describing, but I'm interested in that list of synthetics or of things that are kind of allowed that are outside of, you know, the commonly perceived idea of what an organic whatever is. I mean, there's a list of things that can be used. How big is that list?
You know, it has grown over time. It's now around 200 items. Most of them are for processed food. So it's not so much anything that's going on at the farm. It's really about in the manufacturing plant when you have certain things that might have a vitamin component, a preservative component, that sort of thing. And that's why you've seen the list grow over time, because when organic was really coming into its own, it was still mostly your fresh fruits and vegetables. That was really the most of it, not even livestock, because livestock came on later.
Right.
And the processing part of the food aisle for organic has grown up over time, and it's really those manufacturers that have come in with requests for different substances on the national list that really weren't foreseen when the law was written, because that industry hadn't really come of age.
And then one by one, each of those substances, those synthetics, has to be evaluated by the standards board, the NOSB.
Right. So it's a very complicated process. First, there's a whole lot of research that's done on the individual material that's being voted on. And then the NOSB takes public testimony. It's put in the Federal Register so people know it's coming up. People are allowed to testify before the NOSB if they have strong feelings for or against. And then the board votes whether or not to recommend it to the secretary. And for it to be recommended to the secretary, it requires a two-thirds vote. Why two-thirds? The reason is when we constructed the law, we wanted to make sure that the organic industry couldn't dominate, that they would require, given the composition of the board, that would require buy-in from the environmental and consumer members on the board to get to that two-thirds.
We're kind of getting into the weeds here, but I know that that has kind of evolved in the past. A two-thirds majority was needed to allow certain synthetics to be used. And then last fall, the USDA issued new rules where a two-thirds majority is needed to remove synthetics from the list of allowed exceptions, which makes the use of synthetics maybe a little bit easier and not as hard as it used to be. Do you know why that was changed?
Well, I would disagree with your characterization. So the issue, and I am familiar with this issue, the law requires that after 5 years of something being on the national list, being on this list of exemptions, that it gets sunsetted and it has to be reconsidered. What this is about is, what is the process going forward when you have these materials sunsetted? With the difficulty and all the time, work, energy, and money it takes to get things through the Federal Register and get all that public comment, and with the number of materials, the idea here is to, if something has been on the national list since the program began, and everyone pretty much thinks it's solid, it's good, there's a great rationale for being there, you don't have to go through the whole rigmarole all over again. This would allow the NOSB to focus its energies on materials that really are of concern or are debatable or that people really want to discuss and not get overwhelmed by the volume of work. So it's really not about new materials coming in. It's about how do you look back at ones that you've already approved. What's the onus there to reopen a case file, so to speak, and reexamine?
So in some ways, it's about extending the life of a substance that's kind of already on the list because it's already gone through that approval process.
So it's defining how you do that sunset process.
All right, Kathleen Merrigan, we've gotten a little bit of a sense of the group that sets organic standards, that board. Can we talk a little bit about who actually carries out the certification of organic products? It's a different process. Who is actually certifying these products as organic?
It's a free marketplace of private certifiers for the most part, in a smaller number of cases, state government certifiers in this country. So Anyone who wants to be in the certification business, which means the inspection business, making sure that the entity being inspected, either the farm or the processor, they're complying with the federal standards. Anyone who wants to be in that business has to be accredited by USDA. They have to go through a process that shows that they have the training, the capacity, the systems in place to do that job, because they're basically then allowing the regulated entity to get that USDA seal, that USDA label. So they're, in some ways, they're agents of the federal government, even though they're private and they may charge whatever fees and they may set up their business in various ways. For people outside of the country, they also have to follow U.S. standards if that food's going to be sold here. And there are a variety of ways that that can occur. There could be an overseas, say it's Mexico, our neighbor down south. There could be a Mexican organization that applies for and receives USDA accreditation. And so therefore, they can certify to USDA standards being based in Mexico. Or a Mexican farm or processor could hire a U.S.-based certifying agent to come down to Mexico and certify that the product meets U.S. standards. So there are a variety of ways of doing it, but in this country or other countries, there's no question that it has to be certified to U.S. standards, not in other countries.
Okay, and so there are, I mean, just to get this out of the way, there are different standards of what organic means in different countries.
There are, but there's a lot of convergence increasingly over the years as we've sort of looked each other over. When I was Deputy Secretary, I had opportunity to sign an equivalency agreement with Canada, with the European Union, where we basically acknowledge that for the most part, our standards are the same. And then that eliminates the need to do double certification. So if someone is certified under Canadian law as organic in Canada, that can be sold here in the United States because we've said it's essentially the same. And there's a lot of countries lining up to try to work with the U.S. to get that kind of equivalency arrangement. It's good for their farmers, and it's also good for our farmers who want to sell in those countries because the bureaucracy is much, much less if you can just say it's all the same.
Right. You don't have to apply it at so many different levels or in so many different channels throughout the world. Right. Something you mentioned is the certification internationally. Let's say you grow coffee beans that you want to sell here that are coming from somewhere outside of the United States. You mentioned that there might be a certifying group in that country or that conceivably there would be a private company that does this and goes to someplace in the world to certify it. A complaint that I've heard from people on occasion is that it's an expensive process and therefore out of reach to farmers both here and around the world. And maybe you're even following the strictest of standards, but if you can't pay the certifier their fee, you can't use the label. Is that the case?
In this country, Congress has provided a cost-share program for our farmers that's progressive in nature, meaning that if you're a really small guy, the government contribution toward that cost of certification is going to be very, very helpful. The threshold is it can be up to $750 cost share assistance. So for the smaller guys, that really makes organic financially viable. I think more than the cost of certification, people have been sort of challenged by the bureaucratic paperwork nature of organic, and some people have opted out. I hear about the cost thing, but I don't buy the cost argument as much. But when people say, hey, you know, it's a lot of forms, I'm very sympathetic. And I know that's something that USDA is working on.
How much does it actually cost to get the organic certification?
It depends on the size and also the complexity of the operation. If you have, you know, so many acres and you're really just doing the same thing in all those acres, that's going to be easier, faster probably to certify than something that's a very complex series of crops and you may have livestock too. It really varies, and farmers out there understand that there are a variety of certifiers that they can hire. So it is a competitive marketplace. People, it's not a monopoly. You don't have just one certifier who can set a fee and say, live with it because you have nowhere else to turn. You do have other places to turn.
We've been speaking with Kathleen Merrigan, former USDA Deputy Secretary, Director of the Sustainability Institute at the George Washington University, about what constitutes organic in the United States and about who certifies that. This is the first in a two-part conversation. Tune in tomorrow when we talk about how the meaning of organic has changed over the years and about the battle to label foods containing genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. We'll be right back. Thanks again for joining us for The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Mr. Tyler Ford and Ryan Cunningham. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, as I mentioned, tune in for the second part of our conversation with Kathleen Merrigan about organic food labeling. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.